case, no attorney on the other side or any other appellant was prevented from speaking. In MR's case, one of the opposing parties, Mr. Pente, was offered the opportunity and afforded the opportunity to appear by telephone. So there's an element of prejudice here. My client, MR, wasn't allowed to appear by telephone. MP was allowed to appear by telephone. Third, MR is seeking to challenge the constitutionality of MnStat 260C.301, at least as it applies to facts of this case. In the Coates case, this issue was not raised in the motion to vacate. In my case, if you look at page 14 of my memorandum, it was. Next, appellant had a reasonable excuse for appearing. She was in court in Kandy, Ojai County on a criminal matter. In Coates, the appellant didn't even have an adequate excuse. Next, the district court in this case erred by finding prejudice due to the delay in permanency. I submit that this is not the kind of prejudice that Findon was referring to. Findon was referring to legal prejudice, which means absence of a witness, destruction of evidence, or another sort of thing that prejudices your legal case. And the reason I believe that that's the kind of prejudice that is required is that you would have this in every single TPR case if personal prejudice were the meaning of the term. And the reason that would be the case is that always in a TPR appeal, the children are away from the parent. Otherwise, there wouldn't be an appeal. So the children are with either a foster family or a relative. And so in every case, if a delay in permanency were the kind of prejudice that we're talking about, the appellant would always lose as a matter of law, virtually.
Well, not necessarily. Now, if the person bringing the post-default motion had a good defense on the merits.
Well, good defense on the merits, though, as I see it, on Findon, is a separate issue from prejudice. The four issues in Findon seem to be: one, defense on the merits; two, reasonable excuse; three, lack of prejudice; and four, that did I mention that they had a reasonable excuse?
Yes, and I want to follow up about that reasonable excuse. My inspection of the record and viewing the transcript from the first hearing at which the district court found mother to be in default indicates that the only thing that mother's attorney told the court is that he had spoken with her before court, shortly before court, and that she couldn't get a ride to the courthouse. There was no information relayed to the court at that hearing about where mother was, the fact that she was in Kandy, Ojai County, the fact that she was at a hearing in connection with a criminal proceeding. It was merely information relayed to the court about the fact that she couldn't get a ride. And so is there something in the record that I'm missing?
Well, I think what's important here is that she offered, and her attorney indicated, that she offered to appear by phone.
I understand
so
that.
Put her to
I'm
the
talking
test.
About the reasonable excuse that was related to, that you say existed, and I'm trying to find out what the court knew when it found mother to be in default.
What appears to be the case from the transcript is that the court raised the issue, why isn't she here, does she have an excuse, and then she has a colloquy with one of the welfare workers, and then she comes to the conclusion after the colloquy, which unfortunately is not on the record, that this isn't a reasonable excuse. So I
well,
think
I
the
don't
way
know
they,
what wasn't on the record because it wasn't on the record. So I'm just talking about the transcript here, which is page 3 from September 10, 2018.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the only things are that are in the record is that the attorney for MR says that the client is in Kandy, Ohio.
I'm telling you, that's not what the record says. I will read to you from the transcript on page 3, from September 10, 2018. Mr. Mueller was speaking, and it says, "And Your Honor, just an FYI for the court. Maria Ramos did call into court administration a little bit earlier, and then I subsequently talked with her. She would like to appear by phone today. She wasn't able to get a ride. If appear by phone, if that's possible." And then he explains that he talked to her. He didn't know if it was possible or not. There's no mention of Kandy, Ohio County, of criminal court, or anything else. And I'm trying to ask you if there is something in the record that would suggest otherwise.
Take a look at the affidavit of Maria Ramos.
I did.
Which
I'm just saying that the court didn't have the benefit of that affidavit on September 10, 2018.
No, but it had the benefit of that affidavit when we had the vacation hearing.
It did. And one thing I noted about that affidavit is that it doesn't tell the court when she was in court. It says she has had a previous commitment for a sentencing in Kandy, Ohio County. It doesn't say at 8 in the morning, 10, 12, 2, 4. She just had a commitment, a previous commitment for a sentencing.
But that indicates that it would have conflicted with her appearance in Renville County.
Well, that's your interpretation of the affidavit.
But I think previous commitment obviously implies an inability to get down there.
Okay.
That coupled with the fact that she couldn't get a ride.
The other thing about this affidavit that I found peculiar is that it states, and I'm paraphrasing, that she called Mr. Mueller and told him of the conflict, which he brought to the court's attention. Now, that is not in the record. And you didn't submit an affidavit from Mr. Mueller. So the only thing I know from this record that Mr. Mueller knew on September 10th is that his client called and said, "I can't get a ride."
But that's coupled with her statement that she said the effect that she had a conflict and was in Kandy, Ohio County Court.
But counsel, at the court's ultimate decision on the default judgment motion, on addendum, 7, the court, it says, verified that criminal sentencing occurred at 10:30 in Kandy, Ohio, and it left her enough time to get to Renville by 1:30. Are you taking issue with that factual finding that there was, as I read that factual finding, it basically the court is saying there was enough time to make it, therefore it's not a reasonable excuse. That's the ultimate conclusion of law. It's not a reasonable excuse. Are you taking issue with factual finding number 6?
Yes, because all it says is I checked with someone, presumably welfare, but that isn't evidence. What a judge makes as a finding requires something to be in the record to back it up. The mere fact that a judge says something doesn't mean that it's true or doesn't mean it's based on evidence.
And is it contrary, is what the court found in paragraph 6, contrary to the affidavit testimony that your client submitted relative to her conflict, her scheduling?
I believe
conflict?
It is.
And how does
I
it
believe
conflict
it is.
With it?
Well, she indicated, it was pretty clear, that she wasn't able to make it to Renville County. If that's the case, then one of two things is the case. She wasn't able to get a ride at any time after being in Kandy, Ohio County. It isn't just that she would have had time to make it to Kandy, Ohio County, to find a ride, to talk to a friend, to get money to pay for a taxi or whatever. There are many reasons why she couldn't have made it down other than the fact that the dates and the times did not conflict.
So, okay, so you're not taking issue with the court's fine. You're taking issue with how the court determined that there was sufficient time between the hearings, but you don't say that her, I mean, there's no evidence that, for example, no, they weren't scheduled at the exact same time. I mean, there's not evidence in the record showing that, right? Okay.
No.
But you're just saying there were other reasons that the court should have found based on her affidavit, and that it was clearly erroneous not to find that she lacked transportation?
I think the most important point is this. Okay, that either she did or did not have adequate time for the transportation or adequate transportation available. The issue is this, though. Why not call that number that her attorney was willing to do and put her to the test?
Can you speak to also, before you run out of time, the reasonable defense on the merits element, please? What is the reasonable defense on the merits that you have submitted or that was submitted by your client prior to this hearing?
Okay. Well, the record indicates that she did attend some of the hearings. She had parented the children for years. She did not contact Human Services on several occasions, and she had telephone contacts with her children. I submit that reasonable defense on the merits in 4601 may differ a bit from reasonable defenses on the merits on 60.02, because the kinds of things that come up in a TPR have less to do with specific facts than overall attitudes, overall kinds of actions, and these are the sorts of things that require oral testimony. Obviously, she was in a position, had she been on the other side of the telephone, that she could have detailed the kinds of things that she did. These are generalities, but remember an important thing in Findon, that a showing on one of these four can be quite weak as long as it exists. And indeed, if there's a basic violation of procedural rights, as I submit there is here, then you don't even have to make a showing on the other portions of Findon.
So what is the evidence that the parent, I mean, if we, like, tied to the statutory definition of abandonment, which I think is the statutory basis, right, for the termination here?
I thought it was palpably unfit.
Oh, maybe I'm, I... well, let's see. Paragraph 1 of the conclusion of law is abandoned. On addendum 4, right? And I think that's a statutory basis, is abandonment, B1. So knowing what abandonment means, I'm just wondering, you know, the definition of it, what the evidence is that she did not, her defense to that, I guess. Had she had
her
contact, was there evidence that she had contact with the children on a regular basis?
Well, there was certainly contact by phone. How regular it was, again, would have depended on her testimony.
But does she not need to put in an affidavit on a motion to reopen what that defense would be, some showing that she actually has some regular contact with the children that would defeat an allegation of abandonment?
I submit two things. One, that no, she wouldn't have to do it if there's any evidence of the record of it. And second, I don't think that she has to do it if the other portion, and particularly the judge not letting her appear by telephone, is egregious. Remember, we're talking here about a constitutional right, and one of the differences in Coates is that I raise a constitutional issue in my motion, whereas Coates found out that it didn't. Frankly, my opinion is that if anything is stronger than Coates, in this case is, Coates managed to squeak by with one vote over some extremely rigorous and intelligent dissents.
Mr. Torgelson. Mr. Torgelson?
Yes.
You have to talk to us in order for us
to see you. Certainly. Good afternoon, Your Honors. The court, district court, acted appropriately here in doing a default judgment. At prior hearings that the mother had appeared at, she had been warned that she needed to appear for future hearings or risk having a default judgment against her. Looking at the four factors in Findom as cited in Coates, as the court alluded to, for the first factor would be whether there was reasonable excuse for failure to appear at the hearing. Here, it is noted, at least on the court's record at the time, there really wasn't a reasonable excuse offered. Post the hearing, it was produced that she had to appear at a hearing in Candiohi County. Somehow she was able to secure transportation to that hearing, and there was a 3-hour differential between that hearing in Candiohi County and the hearing that was conducted here in Renville County, and no real excuse for why, if she was able to appear in Willmar, that she wasn't also able to appear here in Olivia for this hearing.
Counsel?
Counsel?
I think that the district court had the discretion to allow mother to participate in the hearing by telephone. Don't you think that the fact that the court allowed the father of the three girls to appear by telephone, that's at least creates an appearance of unfairness if the court allows one party to appear by telephone but not another who's requesting to do so?
I think here appearances beside, there had been, frankly, a history with this mother of not appearing or being even obstructive of hearings that she did appear at. And so I'll concede it's possible that the court was more deferential to MP than was to the mother here, but I think that was based largely on the court's past history with both of those respective parties.
Were there any hearing, there was an admit-deny hearing on August 1, which MR attended, and then she missed the pretrial on September 10. Was there any hearing between August 1, the admit-deny hearing, and the September 10th hearing, do you know?
I don't believe that there were any review hearings as such scheduled between those times or any other hearings.
I apologize if I'm getting the Findom factors out of order. Would you please address Mr. Mack's argument that that prejudice factor under Findom refers to legal prejudice, not personal prejudice, and provide us with any case law that you have that says that relying that the personal prejudice, which is clearly there's no question there is prejudice to this child and not having a permanent home, but any support for why that should be count under Findom?
I'm afraid I don't have any precedent on that particular issue.
I mean, the prejudice needs to be judged as of the point of the default hearing, presumably, right? And that was, I don't even know when trial was scheduled. It was sometime after September, and the default hearing was in November. I'm trying to understand what actual prejudice there could be if there wasn't even meant to be a trial yet until sometime closer to November. Why reopening it would create prejudice? We shouldn't count the time on appeal, presumably, because we're measuring it as of the time of the default motion.
Yes, I admit it's hard to see much prejudice to the child beyond just delaying the, and again, that's more a factual rather than a legal prejudice of delaying the permanency any further with regard to ER at least.
Can you speak to the reasonable defense on the merits and respond to the argument that in fact there was sufficient evidence in the record to present that there might be a reasonable defense on the merits?
And would argue that that's probably on behalf of the mother, probably the weakest argument here. As noted by the court, the basis for termination of parental rights here was abandonment. Checking the record, you'll note that the mother never exercised, though given opportunities to, the opportunity for in-person supervised visitation. Concededly did exercise some very limited telephone contact, but the fact that she didn't exercise at all any opportunities for supervised visitation with the children would render this her defense on the merits extremely weak. And also, as noted,
what was the telephone contact? Can you describe factually what amount of contact she made with her children?
I'm not sure the exact number of instances, but even there, it's my understanding that it was very limited.
Mr. Torgelson, one of the issues Mr. Mack raises is the failure to do a relative search. You know that, and you know this record better than I do. Is there any evidence in this record that the county conducted a relative search, or if the county decided not to conduct a relative search, anything in the record about why the county made that decision not to do so?
And here the since the children were placed with their biological father, it was felt that there wasn't, and even with regard to the one child that wouldn't have been a biological descendant of the father here, that father did serve as kind of a father figure. So given that three of the children were placed with the other parent, it wasn't felt that there was a need for further relative search.
Is there anything in the record that reflects what you just said, that for the non-biological child, that this the foster parent did serve as a father figure? I just am trying... I kind of read, what I've read so far is like is almost like we surmise this is what the county was thinking. I'm just asking, is there anything in the record that would demonstrate that to us?
I think it may be more implied just by the fact that they resided together and so on.
So just to
and
be clear,
I'm
sorry, go ahead.
And I would note the statute does define relative as including an individual with whom the child has resided, which I think was the issue here, or had significant contact. And we've gone through the factors of lack of reasonable defense on the merits. The state continues to argue that she did not proffer a reasonable excuse for failure to appear. And so at least two of the factors here, I don't think the mother has met in terms of reopening the default judgment. I guess just in summation, if there are no further questions from the court, State v. Coates, albeit decided by, or Children of Coates, albeit decided by one vote to the Minnesota Supreme Court, clearly upholds the right of a district court to, when a mother does not, or a parent does not appear at a pretrial hearing in a child protection matter, to enter a default judgment, much as would be the case in any other civil sort of matter. And here, the court had warned the mother at prior admit deny hearing of the need to show up for all hearings. And there just aren't the grounds here to reopen a default judgment here. Primarily, the weakest part of the mother's case I would proffer is the lack of reasonable defense on the merits of the case. Again, over, I think it's something like a two-year period here, the mother did not exercise her right to supervise visitation at all, and really made no effort to even contact social workers to comply with the case plan at all, to demonstrate sobriety. That, again, I think factually on the merits, frankly, if this case were remanded to the district court, that there's no reason to think that this would come out any differently factually. And with that, I will conclude my argument.
All right, thank you. Mr. Mack, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. With regard first to the issue of prejudice being legal rather than personal, if you turn to page 4 of my reply brief, I cite Palladium Holdings versus Zuni Mortgage, and it says, although prejudice is always inherent when the trial of a case is delayed, when the only prejudicial effect of vacating a judgment is delay and added expense of litigation, substantial prejudice of the kind sufficient to prevent reopening a judgment is not established. So it's pretty close, pretty clearly talking about legal prejudice, delays, et cetera. With regard to the matter brought up by counsel, that how come she was able to get to Wilmer, we have no evidence one way or the other about where she was living at the time or where she was residing at the time. If she was residing in Wilmer, she could have walked. With regard to the argument that she had been obstructive before and problematical in her actions before the district court, I'd say that if she is obstructive, a phone conference would be better than having her personally in court, because if she became belligerent on the phone, all you have to do is hang up. You don't have to get the sheriff or someone else to remove her from the courtroom. Now, with regard to relative search, to be sure, three of the children were biological children of their father and living with him, but the fourth, E, was not. There is some evidence in here that Lydia Ramos, who is the mother of my client, was at one point having all four of the children. And she thought that having all four was just too much of a burden, so she gave that up. But there's no indication that she would have been unable to parent one of the child, one of the children.
Is there some authority, counsel, what is that issue properly before us? What authority is there that on a termination of parental rights, we review a decision on a relative search? Is there a parent whose rights have been terminated? In what way does she have standing to bring that claim? And in what way did she challenge that decision regarding relative
search? Well, first of all, there's an unpublished case, my client is NS, that came down about a month ago, where this issue was taken up before the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals addressed it, saying that it was a matter that needed to be determined, and my client was determined to have the right to bring it up, even though he was only talking about his sister.
That wasn't a default, though, was it?
No, it wasn't a default, but I think that counts in favor of my client because she wasn't able to bring it up, being unable to attend and being unable to testify to it. If there are no other questions, I thank the court.
Thank you. The arguments have been received, and we are taking the matter under advisement.